We have a very special topic. We're going to talk about guns. We're going to talk about the gun battle, debating the right to bear arms. That is the topic of today's session. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to keep this not political, and I know that's not possible in this conversation, but what I mean is the goal of what I want to present today is to move the discussion away from, you know, party lines, typical talking points, to focus on what does Torah say about owning a gun, possessing a firearm, carrying, gun safety, gun control, gun restrictions, etc. And you might think that maybe there's nothing that Torah says about it, nothing that Halacha says about it. However, you'll find out today there's actually a lot on the topic, a lot of very interesting sources on the topic. Okay, who has fired a gun before in their life? Okay, by the way, all of this is being recorded by the government, just so you know. Joking. So listen, if you fired a gun, you know the feeling, right? There's a certain sensation in firing a gun. I once fired in a shooting range. Was that a 50 millimeter? That was a powerful piece. It was like, what is it? Which one?
You're talking about caliber or millimeter?
Maybe 50 caliber. I don't know. It was like the Matrix gun. You know, like that big?
Desert Eagle.
That's what it was, a Desert Eagle. And I didn't know what it was before I fired it, and that had quite the kickback.
When you're playing Call of Duty all day, all the...
Ah, that's the Vart. Okay, so listen, I didn't realize there were other avenues in finding out this information. Anyway, so look, the gun debate is, it comes up, number one, unfortunately, every mass shooting that happens, so the topic comes up, the debate comes up again. Every election cycle, it comes up again. So these are conversations, controversies that come up again and again and again. And you have primarily two opinions. You have those that say, right to bear arms, freedom, Second Amendment, don't take away my guns. And then you have those that say, no, gun control. We got to have stricter restrictions. We have to limit what types of guns, who owns guns, how you own guns, how you carry guns, where you keep guns, etc. And you have this debate. And it's oftentimes positioned as a debate between, kind of like what we spoke about last time, personal rights, personal autonomy. I have a right to bear arms versus the government's right to infringe on you. I'm not going to go back to the discussion we had last time. That was topic about hostages and ransoms, and that was a specific topic. Today is also a specific topic. I want to focus exclusively on this issue, the issue of gun control. But before we jump into it, I want to give you some statistics. You know what they say, 85% of statistics are made up. Nonetheless, these are coming from what appear to be legitimate sources. By the way, that 85% was also made up. Now, here are some statistics that I found. This is from an organization, a nonprofit organization that keeps track of mass shootings. By the way, mass shooting is defined as a shooting of four or more individuals, or four or more people are victims of the shooting. It doesn't mean necessarily fatalities, it means that four people were shot in one scenario. So, in 2020, which is this year, right? We are June 17th? Who can keep track anymore? June 17th, so we're about halfway through the year. There are already 202 mass shootings in the United States. Now, you're probably thinking, 202? I probably heard of 10, 20 of them. Listen, not everything gets reported and not everything comes into our focus. I looked on this website, this organization that keeps track of it. I'll tell you the name of it in case anybody wants to look it up at any point in time. It is called Gun gunviolencearchive.org. Gunviolencearchive.org. They maintain this archive. I looked up shootings in the last 72 hours, not even mass shootings, but shootings, gun violence in the last 72 hours in Atlanta. There's like 3 or 4 shootings in Atlanta. And I guess that probably shouldn't be surprising. Nonetheless, you know, you don't really hear about it. At least I don't hear about it, but these things are happening. But that's regular shootings. This is mass shootings, 202 so far this year. And that's with Corona, right? That's with people like sheltering in place and not being as out there as usual. Just so you know, last year in 2019, for the whole year, there were more mass shootings than days in the year. There was a total of 417 mass shootings last year. From 2014 through today, as of this morning, when I checked these stats. So 2014 is the first year that they kept these statistics. So from 2014 through today, there have been 2,288 mass shootings just in the United States alone. Now, the United States, as you know, probably has the most mass shootings, you know, as opposed to other countries. But this is U.S. statistics. 2,288 mass shootings. It's a big number. 202 for the year. It's a big number. So when people hear this number, like I said, the debate rages anew. You know, people say you gotta have gun restrictions. This is crazy. Or the AR-15s or other semi-automatic weapons, we gotta take them away. Can't have these on the streets. Can't have people purchase guns just willy-nilly like this. You have this, and then people say, no, Second Amendment, right to bear arms. You can't take it away. You're infringing on my rights. Each side pulls out emotional arguments, statistics, constitutional arguments. Everyone digs in. And nothing gets resolved. The cycle repeats itself, and it keeps on going. So the goal today is to present the core of the issue, and then again to explore this from a Torah, halacha, hashkafa perspective. But before we get to the Jewish stuff, let's explore the status of guns right now in the U.S. Let's talk about federal law. It becomes a little bit more complicated when we talk about state law, because every state is a little bit different. So let's talk about federal law. What does the U.S. government, right, on a federal level, on a national level, say about gun laws? So here's the first thing you need to know. The Brady Act of 1993 requires gun stores, amongst the requirements, it requires gun stores to run instant criminal background checks before selling firearms. So if you own a gun store, right, and you want to sell a firearm to somebody, you must run them through a national database, a criminal background check, to see if anything pops up. So that's the first point. However, and here's the big loophole. This is the big loophole. You might be familiar with this, but for those of you that aren't, the big loophole is private sales. Okay, if you are privately selling a firearm, you do not need to run that person through a database to do a criminal background check. The government, the federal government, does not put that requirement on private individuals. It just doesn't do that. So here's where it gets interesting. At a gun show, and sometimes this is misconstrued. I've had many conversations with many people who own firearms, who bought them at gun shows, and there's sometimes a misconception that needs a clarification, but there's still a loophole. Let me clarify all of this stuff. Basically, if you go to a gun show, there are different vendors in a gun show. And vendors that are officially licensed sellers of firearms, if you want to buy from their little stand, from their table, from their kiosk at a gun show, imagine you go to a conference center in a big city. In Atlanta, you go to a conference center, a big hall, and it's a gun show. Okay, formal, official gun sellers, if you want to purchase from them, they're going to run your name, your social, through a criminal database to do a background check. Fine. But if you have a private seller who's selling his gun collection, Right? So, Billy Bob from Alabama, right? Obviously, Billy Bob from Alabama, right? Who else would it be? Is selling his, you know, he's got 50 guns and he wants some cash. So he's selling 10 of his firearms and he decides to stop by, you know, the local or the, you know, the state over the Atlanta gun show. So he goes there and he has his guns there and you want to purchase one of his guns. Guess what? No requirement to run a background check. This is what's called the great loophole, or I don't know what the formal name is, but this is a big loophole for purchasing firearms, because here you can have somebody coming off the street, a criminal, somebody with a history of violence or violent threats, and no one can stop them. No one is stopping them from purchasing from a private party in a gun show a firearm. Now, the truth is it doesn't have to be at a gun show. Anyone could sell it from their own home. You could sell it out of the back of a car, theoretically. In other words, again, it could be state by state. Some states have more restrictions on that. But from a federal, I might preface before, on a federal level, on a national level, there's no restriction on private party sellers to sell firearms without any background checks. There's no need to do a criminal background check. You don't need any forms. You don't need a sale record. You don't even require the person's ID. You, as the seller, as a private seller, the federal government, U.S. law, does not require you as an individual, private seller, to make a photocopy of the other guy's ID, to record it, to give a receipt, to in any way, or take that person's ID, in any way, mark the sale. Which means, by the way, that there's no record, formal record of that sale anywhere. There's no database, national database, that has a record of all gun sales. It simply doesn't exist. So that's just, again, just a reality of the state of, nope, not trying to confuse anyone, but the status of gun laws on a federal level today. In addition to the points that I mentioned, number one, the Brady Act of 1993 requires official gun sellers, like real stores, to do a background check, whereas private party sellers don't. In addition, one more point that I want to mention is that fully automatic weapons are banned. You cannot sell, you cannot buy fully automatic weapons, but semi-automatic weapons are legal. And you and I know that semi-automatic weapons can be converted, aftermarket pieces, into either more automatic or completely automatic weapons. There are ways to convert these firearms, but if they're semi-automatic weapons, they are legal based on federal law. So, yeah.
According to federal law, isn't it also all guns purchased before, I think the law was made against them in 1986 or 87, they are legal to be owned.
Yeah, those guns are grandfathered in. They're legal.
Yeah.
You're talking about fully automatic?
Fully automatic.
Yes, you can buy fully automatic machine guns from the Vietnam War.
Yeah, correct. They're grandfathered, exactly. Yeah, they're grandfathered in. So, I mean, listen, that's certainly a segment. Who knows how well they work? Maybe they work perfect. But the point is that these are some of the laws and restrictions and loopholes. Thank you for pointing that out. And loopholes that exist in the current and federal law. Now, every state has its own unique twist and angle on, you know, this requirement, that requirement. That requires, you know, a very comprehensive discussion, you know, to choose the state and to focus on it. I didn't choose Georgia. I didn't choose New York. I'm just giving you federal law kind of as an overview. By the way, when it comes to permits, right, do you need a permit to buy a gun? Do you need a permit to carry a gun? Again, that is something that's state by state. Some states require it. Some states do not. Who is familiar with New York? What does New York say? Guys?
Well, if you need a permit or a license, yeah, you do.
What about carrying?
Yeah, I don't think you can open carry, but you need a license for concealed and everything.
Yeah, there are places in Georgia where you can open carry. Not only that, there's a place, Kennesaw, Georgia. I believe, last time I checked, because I'm friends with the shliach in Kennesaw, Rabbi Zalman Charitan, and he tells me that in his town in Kennesaw, it's actually a law that you have to have a firearm. You read, you get that one? You actually have to own a firearm. That's what he's told me. I haven't verified. I haven't fact-checked him. So you can fact-check me right now. Kennesaw, Georgia, let me know in a moment if you can fact-check me and either verify or debunk this as an urban legend. But that's my understanding. Okay, but moving on. So there are good rationales out there for more gun restrictions. People look at federal law and say it's too lax, too many loopholes, too many ways to purchase.
It's real.
It's real, right? Yeah. I didn't doubt it, but I just wanted to leave enough possibility in case it wasn't correct. That you have to have a firearm, you're saying?
The head of every household needs a firearm.
Yeah, pretty incredible, right? A little bit different than New York, just a little bit different. But you see how, you know, this is left up to the discretion of state by state, even county by county or township by township. It's very much on a local level. And people have a problem with this. Many people say, no, the government, we need a national referendum. We need reform at the top on a national level. Can't leave it up to the local jurisdictions and the whims of local elected officials. This has to be government policy. U.S. law has to come down and say no more automatic weapons, no more private sale loopholes, you know, none of this stuff. We have to have tighter restrictions on who owns firearms, on us tracking on a government level, right? Making sure that the right people are buying these, owning these, trained to use these, safely storing guns, locking them down perhaps behind, you know, different lockboxes or password. They have, you know, different fingerprint locks on firearms. But those that are advocating gun law reform are basically saying that there needs to be more restrictions on a federal level, on a national level, regarding guns. And then, of course, on the other side, Second Amendment. Folks who say, don't touch the guns. Stay away from the guns. Step away from the gun. And by the way, if you get too close, I may have some guns, right? I mean, that's literally what comes out. And anytime there's the talk of legislation that many people believe is reasonable restrictions, there's a lot of force coming from the other side saying, don't touch the guns. And again, like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of emotion on both sides. You should know, studies have shown. I think the Pew Research Center did a study a few years ago. Basically, a vast majority of Americans across party lines, about 85% of Americans, believe that there should be reasonable, some stricter measures on guns on some level. Restrictions on gun sales, who should own gun sales, maybe closing that loophole of private sales. You know, everyone is required to show ID and run through a criminal background check. Most people believe in some sort of reasonable gun reform. The question, though, is, of course, who decides? How far should they go? And that's when things flare up. And over the last number of years, nothing really has advanced or progressed in this measure just because it becomes such a volatile issue. Before we get to one more thing before we get to the Jewish conversation, and I think you're going to find this fascinating. I want to share with you some of the U.S. legal position on the right to bear arms, because it's not so simple. I've already mentioned 2, 3, or 4 times today the Second Amendment. And famously, the Second Amendment is presented as providing the right to bear arms. It's not so simple. What I want to do is I want to share my screen with you. Let's see if I can do this. Oh, I can't do this. Levy, can you make me co-host?
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. Let me know when that's in.
Go ahead, try now.
Ah. Amazing. I need to share with you some texts over here. Okay. Let me know if you can see this. Yeah? Yes? Thumbs up? Okay.
Yeah.
Take a look at text number 2 over here. This is Second Amendment. This is straight up Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Okay, here's the quote. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And they thought they were writing clearly. I'm not sure what the kavanah here was. It's a little bit crazy when you... Huh?
It's the elastic clause, the constitution specifically written vaguely.
Okay, good. That's what I was going to get to. But I'm going to read this one more time. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, here's the problem. So it starts off by talking about a well-regulated militia, which is necessary to the security of a free state. So this is kind of like on a larger scale. And then it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So the question is, are we talking about the state having the right to have a militia against the federal government if necessary? Or are we talking about the right of the people to keep and bear arms? You should know that this is the subject of a fierce legal debate. And it's so fierce that in 2008, the Supreme Court ruled on this, on that very language that I just showed you. And the decision came down 5-4. I'm going to tell you soon what the decision was and how it came down. But that by the most narrow of margins, 5-4, the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled in 2008 on their understanding of the meaning of the Second Amendment. It's not clear-cut. If you think that it's absolutely clear-cut, kol hakavod, but I'll tell you this, it's not so clear-cut. There are 2 ways to read it. Now, you may prefer one way. I may prefer one way, for sure. That's without question. But I think you need to acknowledge, or you don't need to do anything, but I think it's important to recognize that there are 2 ways to read this. Now, the case that I want to focus on, the U.S. legal case that I want to focus on is known as D.C. versus Heller. What happened, I'm going to give you the background. In 1975, the District of Columbia, a.k.a. D.C., right? District of Columbia passed very restrictive gun laws, basically saying, this was in 1975, basically saying that by 1976, so within 1 year, all firearms in the District of Columbia must be registered. Okay?
2008.
Sorry?
D.C. versus Heller was 08.
Correct. D.C. versus Heller was 08, and that's when the Supreme Court ruling came down, as I mentioned a moment ago. But I'm taking you back into the background of D.C. versus Heller. Where does D.C. versus Heller come from? It starts in 1975. 1975, D.C. passes the most restrictive, one of the most restrictive gun laws in the country. Remember, federal law is federal law, but every state, every district can pass its own laws. So D.C. passes very restrictive gun laws. They basically said that you must register any firearm in D.C., in the District of Columbia, must be registered within 12 months, before 1976. And no firearms will be registered after 1976. Basically saying you cannot newly purchase or own firearms after 1976 because you're not going to get a permit. You're not going to get that registration passed. You need a special license to carry firearms even in home. Even at your own home, you have to keep the firearm, your firearm, if it's registered before 1976, you still have to keep, it has to be registered, even in your house, you have to have, it has to be unloaded, disassembled, or trigger locked in order for you to even have it at your home, even if it was registered before 1976. These were incredibly restrictive gun laws. So if you moved to DC in the year, I don't know, 1995 or 2000, right, and you wanted to purchase a gun in D.C., legally, you cannot. You could not. So what happened was a fellow named Heller and 5 other D.C. residents, they sued. They sued straight up. They sued the District of Columbia. They said these laws are unconstitutional. They said it's violating their Second Amendment rights. It's very nice that the District of Columbia thought in 1975 that they could pass these laws, and maybe they weren't challenged then, But this happened in 2004. In 2004, a fellow named Dick Heller says, enough is enough. And with five of his compadres, he says, that's it, we're suing the District of Columbia. They took the District of Columbia to court. They said the law in D.C. is unconstitutional, violating our Second Amendment rights, which give us the freedom to bear arms. You tell me I can't get registered to purchase a firearm? That's illegal. Infringing my rights. What happens is it goes to the district court in 2004. The district court rules against Heller. Why? Take a look at this. I'm going to share my screen with you again. Take a look at the ruling. This is the original ruling. Again, it goes through three layers. So hold up here for a second. So the first ruling is right here. This is district court opinion. Now, the original case was Parker v. District of Columbia. Parker was one of the other five. It eventually became Heller. He became the lead, but then it was Parker. Take a look at text three. This court, this is the D.C. court, the district court ruling. This court is not persuaded that a well-regulated militia means each able-bodied person separate and apart from his or her enrollment or association with a militia. As the 11th Circuit and the plain meaning of the Second Amendment make clear, a militia must not be a free-for-all. Rather, a militia must be a well-regulated fighting force, implying at the very least some semblance of organization at the state or local level. The district court rules that the Second Amendment, I'm going to go back to the previous reading, which was the Second Amendment itself, that the Second Amendment, when the Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That means a well-regulated militia, an organized official group. Mr. Heller, Mr. Parker, Mr. Other three people, y'all, as we would say in the South, are not a well-regulated militia. You're people, you are people that want to hold, buy guns or keep guns in your house without these restrictions. It doesn't apply to you. That was the original ruling. Well, you can imagine the litigants appealed. They appealed the decision to the U.S. Appeals Court, and guess what? That case, they won. The U.S. Appeals Court for D.C. Reversed the ruling, saying that the Second Amendment right here, the Second Amendment, does indeed protect the individual's right, the people's right as individuals, not only a well-regulated militia, but the right of the people as individuals to keep and bear arms. So again, ruling number one, the original court was no individual right. Ruling number two was yes, individual right. Well, at that point, D.C., the District of Columbia, decides to appeal to the highest court. And they appeal to the Supreme Court, which is also in Washington, D.C., ironically enough. And the case gets heard by the U.S. Supreme Court justices. It goes to the court, I believe, in 2007. The Supreme Court agreed to hear it in November of 2007. And they gave their ruling June 26, 2008. And as I mentioned before, by a 5-4 ruling, the court affirmed the U.S. Appeals Court, the U.S. Appeals Court for D.C., they affirmed that second ruling, and they said by the slimmest of margins that the Second Amendment does support the individual's right to bear arms. Take a look at some text from the majority opinion. Take a look. Take a look at 4A right here. By the way, just so you know, this case is known as D.C. versus Heller, right? Why D.C. versus Heller? Because remember, D.C., District of Columbia, won the first case, but Heller and the others won the second case. So the final case that went to the Supreme Court was the District of Columbia saying, no, we want to keep our restrictive gun laws in place. We don't want to allow individuals to purchase, register new guns. Okay, take a look at 4A. This is from the majority ruling, the five against the four. The Second Amendment is naturally divided into two parts, its prefatory clause and its operative clause. The former, the first part of the sentence or part of the amendment does not limit the latter grammatically, but rather announces a purpose. The amendment could be rephrased, because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, therefore, I'm adding that word in, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In other words, the majority ruling, and I have more text that I could share with you, but I don't want to monopolize the time with this ruling, although I think it's fascinating. The majority ruled that when you read the Second Amendment, so the understanding is the Iker and the Tuffel, the Iker is the right of the people to keep and bear arms. That's the Iker. The Tuffel is the beginning, the preamble that says about the militia, a state, etc. So that's kind of a preamble. Because we need a militia sometimes to protect the interests of the state, etc. Therefore, every individual has a right to keep and bear arms, and that's an individual right. That's how the Supreme Court ruled in 2008, and it has not been overturned. There's never been another ruling on that level, on that matter, which means that as it stands today, the understanding based on the highest court of the land that is entrusted with interpreting and preserving the Constitution, it's basically telling us that, yes, the individual does have a right to keep and bear arms. But I will tell you, there was fierce dissent on the other side in that 2008 ruling. Four judges disagreed. And those judges had their own opinions. And they said, are you kidding me? You're telling me that the first part that talks about a well-regulated militia is not a key point to the whole finale of this Second Amendment, which is the right to keep and bear arms? The only point of this amendment is because of the militia, because of the fear that the federal government would impose its will on the states. Therefore, the states need to have this protection. And when it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it means the people as represented by their state, not people as individuals, but people, i.e. the state, as opposed to the federal government. Go figure, right? Or go back a few hundred years and ask the writers of the Constitution what they meant. And as was mentioned before, maybe they purposely left it vague. But the bottom line is, there is an element of vagueness. It is a bit vague, and it's a fascinating debate. Fascinating debate about what the Second Amendment does provide for. So, let's talk about this from a Jewish perspective. Now, let's jump in. What does Judaism say about the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, or the right of a government to impose restrictions on that right? You see, based on that Supreme Court ruling, Heller and his crew were vindicated, right? And the laws in D.C. could be theoretically deemed too restrictive on their Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms. What does Judaism say? What does Torah say about this? What does Yiddishkeit have to say about this? Could there ever be a right to which the law couldn't restrict? The answer is pretty much no. Because again, not looking at this from a United States legal perspective, a constitutional level, but from the perspective of Torah and Halacha, right? What is the halachic perspective of this? We know famously, the Chachamim, the Rabbanim, were given discretion by Torah itself, by Torah Shebiksav. There is an allowance. There is a lot of room for Chazal to make takanas and gzeres, to make decrees and enactments, basically saying, you know what? You think you have this right? We're going to tell you not anymore. Now, of course, there's a framework, there are guidelines for when takanas and gzeres are made. Right, it has to be benefiting the community. It has to be something that is necessary. It has to be something that's doable and feasible. So there are parameters around this, but at its core, the halachic system does not take personal rights so seriously. Right? Somebody says, "I have a personal right to eat chicken with milchiks. It's my personal right. I believe that I have that right." Because look, the Constitution, the Bible, doesn't forbid it. It talks about meat and milk, but not chicken and milk. Shkoyach. Chazal have no problem, Right? The Chacham have no problem saying, all right, we're making it usr. Ah, you're violating rights? There's no rights. What do you mean rights? Who has rights here? What are you talking about rights? Judaism is not a rights-based system. It's a responsibility-based system. It's not about rights. It's about responsibilities and obligations. So, yes, if there's no halacha against it, you know, and it's morally sanctioned, gesunt hate, knock yourself out. But, again, theoretically, halacha would not have theoretically a problem stepping in and saying, you know what, this is getting out of hand. This is becoming dangerous. So maybe based on Torah itself, there's no prohibition, but we're going to step in. I'm not saying that halacha does. That's what we're going to talk about tonight or this afternoon for the next 15 minutes. But theoretically, the concept of stepping in is not out of the realm of possibility. Does what I just say make sense? Yes? That point? Yes? Possibly? I'm going to say it one more time very, very simply. The big debate in the United States is whether or not the government is allowed to restrict. In halacha, that's not the question, whether or not halacha can restrict. The assumption is halacha can. The question is, should halacha restrict? Are you with me on the repositioning of the question? In the U.S., the question is, does the government have a right to take away my guns? In Judaism, that's not the question. The government, or Torah, halacha, certainly does have the right to do whatever it wants. The question is, should it take away that right, so to speak? Should it infringe on this? Should it limit ownership of guns? That's the core question. The core question is not about if there's that ability, but rather should halacha exercise that ability? I want to go through various makaris, various sources in Jewish thought. I'm going to share my screen now for a little bit, so let's jump in. I have 9 different sources on this, but I don't know if we have enough time to go through 9. I don't think we do. So I'm going to keep it as short and as sweet as I possibly can. Okay, the first source is Hilchos Shabbos regarding caring, right? What defines caring outside? Taking from a Rishus HaYachid to Rishus HaRabim, taking from private property to a public domain. So we know you can't just hold something in your hand and walk outside. It's carrying. It's a violation of that malacha. Wonderful. But what about wearing something? What about wearing a watch, wearing a bracelet, wearing a necklace, right? Is that permitted? We know that that is permitted. Why? Because that's not carrying. It's wearing. It's wearing jewelry or adornments. You're allowed to wear clothing outside on Shabbos. It's not considered to be carrying. It's considered to be wearing. What about wearing a sword? What about wearing a bow, a shield, a spear? So the Mishnah in Masechet Shabbos deals with this, Perek Vav. And here's what it says. One may not go out wearing a sword, a bow, a triangular, a round shield, or a spear. Right? So you can't walk out on Shabbos wearing these things. It's not considered wearing, it's considered carrying. Rabbi Eliezer says, no, you're allowed to. They are ornaments to him. Rabbi Eliezer is the minority opinion, and he says you're allowed to carry these things. You're allowed to wear, imagine like a bow and arrow, you know, like that backpack thing. You know what I'm talking about? That, yeah? That whole setup? Okay. Anyway, Rabbi Eliezer says you're allowed to wear that. Why? Because it's like an ornament. It's like jewelry. Yeah, you're allowed to wear a necklace. You're allowed to wear this. A sword around your sword, a belt and a sheath and whatever it is. Yeah, you're allowed to wear a sword on Shabbos. Why? Ornament. But the sages say, look back inside, that they're nothing but a stigma. Einan elalignai. It's not nice. Right? For it is written, quoting from Yeshaya and Micha, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning knives. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. La yisagaya gaycherev. Right? Neither shall they learn war anymore. In other words, weapons are not so nice. So how can you call them ornaments? How can you call them tachshitin? How can you call them jewelry? Yeah? How can you say, Rabbi Eliezer says, tachshitin heinle, they're tachshitin, means jewelry. The Chacham say, are you kidding me? Tachshitin, jewelry. Jewelry is nice. A nice watch, a nice necklace, nice earrings, nice bracelet, That's what takshitin is. You're telling me a sword and a bow and a shield and a spear are takshitin? Chas v'shalom takshitin. Look up times of Mashiach. These things are going to be eliminated. Right? So they're ugly. Maybe they're necessary, but they're ugly. Now, based on this, right, what might we say? Based on this makar, right, thinking about what halacha or what Yiddishkeit, hashkafa would say about gun control or weapons, we might say that, look, keep weapons, you know, keep them away. Because, look, they're not takshitin, it's not nice. There's a perspective on weapons that they're an ugly part of society, so maybe we should restrict them. The counter argument, though, it's not an ironclad source over here. The counter argument, however, is that halacha doesn't prohibit in this Mishnah the concept of a bow, an arrow, swords and shields and spears. All it says is that relative to Hilchos Shabbos, it's not considered takshitin, and you can't walk outside on Shabbos with these items. It doesn't say, though, that all these items are banned. And the truth is, even from the perspective of not being nice, that's relative to Mashiach Zeitin. That's relative to when Mashiach comes. But for now, the reality is we live in a world that is violent. We live in a world that we do need to protect ourselves. So there's no mucker, there's no source here, there's no legitimate or ironclad proof from that text that Yiddishkeit comes on the side of gun control. All right, let's go to source number two. But I'm running through these. We'll leave dialogue and questions. Unless you have a question in understanding, ask it. Otherwise, I want to show you as many sources as I can on this topic. I think it's fascinating. The next source comes from Shmuel. It's about the Plishtim. Again, we have an English translation. It's going to sound a little funny, but work with me on this. There was no blacksmith to be found in all of the land of Israel. This is when the Plishtim were kind of ruling parts of Eretz Yisrael, or they had some sovereignty over there. Because the Plishtim said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. And all the Yidden went down to the Plishtim, to the Philistines, to sharpen their plowshares, picks, axes, and sickles. So on the day of the battle, neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Shaul and Yonasan, but Shaul and Yonasan, his son, did have weapons. The point is, under the rule, you know, again, then in the Shmuel Aleph, it talks about all the wars of the Plishtim and the Yidden. The bottom line is that at that time, they made a law saying that the Yidden could not have basically metal tools. So they didn't have any weapons. And we see how that was a negative thing, because that kept them, right, in battle. That kept them at a disadvantage. So maybe the implication of this text is that gun laws and gun restrictions are not good, because look at how it was used against the Yidden back in the day. It was used by the Plishtim as a way to keep them under their control. So maybe gun restriction is a way for the government to keep the people locked down. So you might have a mucker here from this story that it's a negative. In other words, this was not a good moment in Jewish history. This was not a good time. Shaul and Yonasan violated this law, and they had their own weapons, but the majority of the people did not have weapons, and that wasn't good. They weren't able to defend themselves. So maybe the implication is here that you need this type of weaponry. So maybe you do need guns. The counter-argument is, well, then you had the Plishtim against the Yidden. But now, the federal government has not yet declared war against the people. So who says the citizens need these guns, need these armaments? Maybe they don't. Again, two ways of looking at it, not an ironclad proof. Next source I want to share with you on the matter comes from Bereshis. This is a little bit of an involved discussion, but take a look at this. This is talking about Lemech. All right, interesting fellow. Adabur Yaval. The English translations here. Okay, Adabur Yaval, he was the father of those who dwelt in tents and raised cattle. His brother's name was Yuval. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Tzila, too, bore Tuvakayan, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. And Tuvakayan's sister was Nama. Okay, Lemech said to his wives, Ada and Sila, listen to my voice. Listen to my voice. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. Have I slain a man by wounding him, a child by striking him? So he seems to be defensive. He's telling his wives, who seem to be accusing him of something, have I killed anybody? Have I hurt a child? I didn't do any of that. The question is, what is going on in these psukim? So take a look at what Ramban says. Look at Ramban. This is going to explain everything we just read. Lamech was very wise in many different areas of creative work. He taught one son herding, the other son music, and the third to manufacture and sharpen swords, pikes, spears, and other weapons. His wives were afraid that he would suffer divine punishment for bringing war and death to the world. They accused him of perpetrating the negative legacy of his ancestor Cain, the first murderer. He responded to them, "Unlike Cain, I have not slain a man by wounding him or a child by bruising him. God will not punish me as he did Cain, but surely protect me." Take a look at what Ramban says. I must highlight these words because Ramban lived many years ago, many hundreds of years ago, and look what he says. His argument, Lamech's argument, was that even without a sword or a spear, one could kill by wounding and battering his victim, which is worse than dying by the sword. It is not the sword that kills, its manufacturer commits no sin. Do you understand what he's saying? What Ramban is saying, what Lamech was saying? Literally, the gun debate that's going on right now. The question is, do guns kill people or do people kill people? So Lamech's wives are saying, you're a murderer, you're manufacturing weapons. You're manufacturing things that could become weapons. And Lamech says to his wives, listen carefully. I am not killing anybody. I am not hurting anybody. I'm making metal implements and sharp tools. If people decide to use it for that purpose, it's on them. Number two, even if they didn't have that tool, they would find another way to harm. This is the counter argument when it comes to the gun debate, right? People come down on condemn the guns, and other people say, condemn the guns. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. If there weren't guns, they would find other ways to kill. The counter-argument is, you're making it easier. Mass shootings, it's harder to stab a bunch of people. In the case of Lamech also, his wives might have said back to him, yes, people could kill with their bare hands, but with iron implements, you can be more prolific at it. You can be more efficient at it, and therefore you do have blood on your hands, Lamech. This is a recorded debate in Torah itself, as explained by Ramban. This is straight up psukim in Torah, where they accuse of him something that's unsaid, but his response is, have I done anything? I haven't. I've made the tools, let people do what they want, but it's not on me. So in a sense, what we see here is an argument. His wives are arguing, Lamech's wives are arguing for gun restrictions, and he's saying no. Who's right? Again, it's not a definitive proof because we simply don't have a resolution to that debate. We have the debate, but we don't have the resolution. Let's look at the next source. Famously, I'm gonna summarize this. The Medrash says, right? If somebody comes to kill you, you kill them first, self-defense. So if we have the mitzvah of self-defense, well, then maybe you need a gun. Maybe halacha would say, if somebody is coming at you, because guns exist, right? Somebody, God forbid, comes at a person with a gun, they need a gun to defend themselves. You can't bring a sword to a gunfight. So if the bad guys have guns, the good guys need guns to defend themselves. That's a pretty compelling argument. Based on the argument of self-defense, based on the halacha of self-defense, if someone comes to kill you, you should arise to first kill him. That might seem to imply that you do need guns. Although the counter-argument would be take away all the guns, and then the bad guys don't have guns and the good guys don't have guns. But then the counter to the counter is good luck getting it away from the bad guys. So again, this might lend itself to saying pro-guns. Now, let's look at the next text, which is about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Take a look. Hashem, this is after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hashem, beginning of Parshas B'Shalach. Hashem led the people around by the way of the desert to the Red Sea, and the children of Israel were armed when they went up out of Egypt. The Torah clearly says that they were chamushim. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'aretz Mitzrayim. They came out of Mitzrayim, chamushim, armed. So, seems like being armed is good. However, the counter argument is, yeah, that's because they were going to face enemies on their march to Eretz Yisrael. So maybe they needed guns, or not guns, maybe they needed weapons. But what about now? We're not necessarily facing an enemy. Do we need guns? It's a little, that proof is a little bit vague. Next, this is a very compelling idea. There's a mitzvah of Micah. What's the Micah mitzvah? The Micah is to put up a fence around your roof. Right? V'yasisa, maike, legagecha, place a fence, build a guardrail for your roof. That's the mitzvah. Comes along Rambam, and Rambam says, yeah, this is true not only for a guardrail, right? A fence around your roof. Take a look at Rambam. This requirement, last paragraph here, applies to a roof and similarly to any place that might present a danger and cause a person to stumble and die. So if a person has a well or a cistern in his courtyard, you have to erect a sand wall 10 handbreadths, 10 tefachim high around them to make a cover for them so that a person will not fall in and die. Similarly, it is a positive mitzvah to remove any obstacle that could pose a danger to life and to be very careful regarding these matters, as it says, beware for yourself and guard your life. Okay, so what we see here is there's a prohibition about keeping dangerous things around your house. If you have a roof, it's dangerous. If you have a well, an open well, it's dangerous. An open swimming pool, dangerous, right? Things that are dangerous, you have to protect. Well, what does that say about guns in your house? If you own a gun in your house, based on Rambam, based on this halacha, what would you say? Maybe halacha would say you have to have it in a locked box, because otherwise the children might get to it. Otherwise, you know, it could be gotten in a negative way. So if there's something dangerous in your house, one could argue from the halacha of the Maike that you need to have it locked down. You need to have some sort of barrier or restriction placed over it. So sensible restriction, a lockbox, a fingerprint key to it to engage. Some sensible lockdowns or controls might seem reasonable based on this halacha. The next halacha is also fascinating regarding having a wild dog. Take a look at what the Gemara says, Baba Kama. One should not keep a dangerous dog unless it's kept on a chain. If you have a dangerous dog, you're not allowed to have it unless it's on a chain. One may, however, keep it in a town adjoining the frontier, keeping a chain during daytime, but releasing it during nighttime. Take a look at what the Yaivitz says, Rabbi Yaakov Emden. He says, it seems to me that despite the permission to own a dangerous dog, one should not own more than the one needed to protect one's home. A very simple question. Can you own a dangerous dog to protect your home? Halacha says, yes, but the Yaivit says only one in order to protect your home. It is forbidden to own many dangerous dogs, even if they are chained, unless one owns numerous homes and properties that each require a dog, or one is a shepherd who requires more than one dog, even for one flock of cattle. Anyway, the principle is that to own more than is necessary is not allowed under any circumstances. So from this we see that possessing a wild animal is not so simple. There are restrictions. Again, could that translate into guns? Are guns considered like a wild animal that you need to lock down on some level? Yes, but also no, because dogs can break through. A gun can't shoot itself. So that would be the difference. A wild animal, wild dog, a dangerous dog, could, if it's unchained, it could go out and damage and kill and maim somebody, God forbid. A gun on its own, without human intervention, cannot go out on a shooting spree. So there is still a bit of a difference between the case of the dog and the case of a gun. Next, take a look at market restrictions. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, we may sell to idolaters neither arms nor accessories to arms, and we may not sharpen arms for them. You're not allowed to sell Zion or clay Zion. Basically, you cannot sell weapons to idolaters, to those that might use it against us, right? So the purpose, Rashi says, the purpose of these restrictions is to prevent them from harming Jews. And the Gemara in Avodah Zarah continues to say, Rav Dimi says, just as it is forbidden to sell arms to idolaters, it is also forbidden to sell them to Jewish bandits. So you cannot sell guns to criminals. Sorry, you cannot sell weapons to criminals. This is talking about, of course, before guns. Could we apply this to gun sales? Could we say that halacha would say that there's a prohibition against selling guns to those that might harm the general population? So, if we know somebody's dangerous, you can't sell it to them. Does this advocate for common sense restrictions on gun sales? Like background checks and closing the loophole? Some might argue yes. Here you have sources in Gemara that talk about not selling guns to certain people. So how do you know who to not sell to if you don't do the background check? Some might argue, though, differently. The Gemara only said don't sell to someone that you know is a dangerous person. But what if you don't know? Do you have to do a background check on everybody? The Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara never says here that you have to do a background check. So this is also a little bit vague. But it does seem to imply that we should be a little bit smart about who owns dangerous weapons and who doesn't. Finally, the last text that I want to show you, this is the last one, this is the ninth source. It says regarding the Ari Miklat, it says, we may not sell in the Ari Miklat, in the cities of refuge, weapons or hunting gear. This is the position of Rabbi Nehemiah, but the Chachamim permit it. Now, Rashi explains, Rabbi Nehemiah's rationale is that the avenger, the Goel Adam, should not purchase weapons in the city and kill the person who killed by accident. In terms of the Goel Adam coming to the refuge city with weapons, that would be noticed and the weapons would be confiscated upon arrival. So again, Rabbi Nehemiah's opinion is you don't want weapons in the Ari Miklat, in the Ir Miklat, because we're concerned that the Goel Adam is gonna visit and then purchase a weapon and then stab the one who killed their loved one by accident. We don't want that to happen. What about the fact that they're going to come in with a knife or with a weapon? No, we're going to pat them down before they come into the Ari Miklat, the Ir Miklat, and we're going to make sure they don't bring weapons in there. So we see a few different things. We talk about controlling who's able to purchase weapons, or sell weapons, and also we're talking about possessing in certain places, not allowed to possess weapons. But of course, the caveat here is that's only the opinion of Rabbi Nehemiah. The Chachamim are matir, the Chachamim permitted, so that goes out the window. So we're left with, and this is the final source I wanted to share with you, we're left with a bit of a mixed bag. We're left with some different ideas about this concept, about guns. Some sources seem to indicate that there is permission to have weapons and guns, or we could translate it into guns. Some talk about common sense restrictions. The bottom line is, here are five takeaways from the text that we studied. Number one, weapons are not ornaments. They're not jewelry. They're a blemish on society, maybe a necessary evil, but nonetheless a negative. Number two, weapons are necessary to overthrow oppressive and corrupt regimes. Number three, when somebody comes to kill, you have to be prepared to kill preemptively, which may include having the means, like a gun, to do so. Number four, guns might be very likely considered hazardous objects, and like all hazardous objects, you have to make sure that they don't harm innocent people. And the final point is, steps should be taken probably to ensure they don't end up in dangerous hands. Okay, that's it for today. I think my own conclusion based on all these texts is that based on halacha, based on everything that we studied, it would make sense to look at some reasonable measures to, on some level, minimize the potential for tragedy to emerge from gun sales and gun ownership and gun use, but it's a little bit tricky even from a halachic perspective. Hope this helped. Hope this shed some light on the topic. I see while I was sharing my screen, it looks like we have more of a limited crowd. Thank you for sticking with me and seeing it through. You guys are the best. Let's all be safe, and please God, take it from me out, we should have a time when we will indeed not need any guns and not need any weapons, because la yisa gaya gai cheref, v'la yul medu ayim mechama, we won't have any more need for this, and we will live in more peaceful times. Please God, immediately, now. Miyad mamash.
Thank you, Ari.
Pleasure.